For 25 years, she had worked in all weather beside her husband, Carl Sr. Winters, with steam puffing from her mouth, she'd worn mud boots, a greatcoat, and a scarf over her head firmly knotted below her heavy chin. In fingerless wool gloves knitted late at night, sitting up in bed while Carl snored, she'd perched on a stool, milking cows. In summer, she'd sorted berries, cut runners, pulled weeds, and kept one eye on the Indians and Japanese who yearly picked on the Heine farm. She'd been born in Bavaria, still carried its accent, on a dairy farm near Ingolstadt. She'd met her husband when he came to her father's wheat farm near Hettinger, North Dakota. They'd eloped on the Northern Pacific to Seattle, she remembered eating breakfast in the dining car, where he worked for 2 years in a Harbor Island foundry, and for one loading lumber on the waterfront. Etta, a farmer's daughter, found Seattle to her liking. She was a seamstress on Second Avenue and made Klondike coats at piece rate. The strawberry farm on San Pedro, where they visited at Christmas, belonged to Carl's father, a portly man. Carl had left it at 17, seeking adventure in the world. When his father died, he migrated back, bringing Etta with him. She tried to like San Pedro. It was damp, though, and she developed a cough, and her lower back began to bother her. She had 4 children and raised them to work hard, but the oldest went off to Darrington to set choker cables, and the second and third went off to war. Only the second, Carl Jr., returned. The fourth was a girl who, like Etta herself, eloped and went off to Seattle. Etta grew tired, gut-weary of strawberries. She didn't even like to eat them. Her husband was a true lover of the fruit, but Etta couldn't feel anything for it. To him, strawberries were a holy mystery, jewels of sugar, deep red gems, sweet orbs, succulent rubies. He knew their secrets, the path they took, the daily responses they made to sunlight. The rocks between the rows collected heat, he said, and kept his plants warmer at night than they would otherwise have been, but to this sort of thing she made no answer. She brought him his eggs and went to the barn for milk, threw feed from her apron pockets to the turkeys and chickens, scrubbed the field muck from the mudroom floor, filled the hog trough and walked through the pickers' cabins to see that they hadn't relieved themselves in pilfered canning jars. Carl's heart failed him one clear October night in 1944. She'd found him on the toilet, with his head against the wall, his pants clumped around his ankles. Carl Jr. was away at the war, and Etta took advantage of this circumstance to sell the farm to Ole Jurgensen. That gave Ole 65 acres in the middle of Center Valley. It also provided Etta with enough money to get by on if she was mindful of her pennies. Fortunately, this mindfulness accorded with her nature. It brought her the same depth of pleasure Carl had derived from nurturing his strawberries. Alvin Hooks, the prosecutor, he appeared more nimble than ever in her presence, was keenly interested in Etta's finances. He paced in front of her with his left elbow cradled in his right palm neatly and his chin resting on his thumb. Yes, she said, she'd kept the books for the farm. No, it had never been very profitable, but the 30 acres had gotten them by for 25 years. Better some years than others, she added, depended what the cannery was paying out. They'd cleared their debts by 29, that helped, but then the Depression came along. The price of berries dropped, the farm all needed a rod bearing from Anacortes, the sun didn't shine every year. One spring a touch of night cold ruined the fruit. Another you couldn't get the fields to dry out, and the low-hanging berries rotted. One year the fungus got you, another you couldn't keep the spitbugs down. On top of all that, Carl broke his leg in 36, and spent his time hobbling up and down the rows, chasing after posts or buckets he couldn't carry on account of his homemade crutches. Then he went and put 5 acres into raspberries, and dumped money into that experiment, wire and cedar posts, labor to build trellises. It set them back until he figured how to cull the canes and train them to produce. Another time he tried a new variety, Rainier's, that wouldn't take because he used too much nitrogen. Lots of green, plants high and fluffy, but small, hard fruit. A piddling harvest. Yes, she'd known the defendant, Kabuo Miyamoto, for a good long time, she figured. It was more than 20 years since his family came to pick the defendant, his two brothers, his two sisters, his mother and father. She remembered them well enough. They were hard workers, kept to themselves mostly. They brought their caddies in, mounded up. She marked them off and paid out. They lived in one of the pickers' cabins at first. She could smell the perch they cooked there. She saw them some evenings, sitting under a maple tree, eating rice and fish off of tin plates. They would have their laundry strung between two saplings in a field of fireweed and dandelions. They had no automobile for getting about. She didn't know how they did it. In the mornings, early, two or three of their children went down to Center Bay with hand lines and fished from the pier or swam out to the rocks and tried for cod. She'd seen them on the road at 7 in the morning, coming home with their strings of fish or with mushrooms, with fern tendrils, butter clams, sea-run trout if they got lucky. They walked barefoot. They kept their faces down. All of them wore woven straw-picker's hats. Oh, yes, she remembered them well. How was it she was supposed to forget such people? She sat in the witness stand, staring at Kabuo, and tears pooled in her eyes. Judge Fielding called for a recess then, seeing that her emotions had overwhelmed her, and Etta followed Ed Soames into the anteroom, where she sat in silence, remembering. Zenichi Miyamoto had appeared at her door at the end of his family's third picking season. Etta had been at the kitchen sink, and from there, looking through the parlor, she saw him watching her. He nodded at her, and she stared at him, and then went back to her dishes. Then Carl, her husband, came to the door and spoke to Zenichi with his pipe between his thumb and forefinger. It was difficult to hear exactly what they were saying, so she turned the water off. Etta stood quietly and listened. In a little while, the two men left the doorway and went out into the fields together. From the window over the sink, she could see them. They would stop. One of them would point, they would move on. They stopped again, pointed, swept their arms this way and that. Carl lit his pipe and scratched behind his ear, and Zenichi pointed with his hat to the west, made a sweep, put his hat on his head. The two men walked between the rows some more, made the crest of the rise, and turned west behind some raspberry canes. When Carl returned, she'd put coffee on the table. "What did he want?" she said. "Land," said Carl. 7 acres of it." "Which 7?" Carl had set his pipe on the table. "Due west 7, middle west 7. Leaves plots north and south. I told him better the northwest 7, if I was going to sell. It's hilly, anyway." Etta poured coffee for both of them. "We ain't going to sell," she said firmly. "Not in such times as these, when land is cheap. Not until better times come."
"It's hilly," repeated Carl. "Hard to work. Good sun, bad drainage. Least productive acres on the property, he knows that. That's why he asked for it. Knows it's the only piece I'd think of letting go."
"He wanted the middle 7, Etta pointed out. "Figured he might get a good 2 acres without your noticing it."
"Maybe," said Carl. "Anyway, I noticed."
They drank their coffee. Carl ate a slice of bread spread with butter and sugar. He ate another. He was always hungry. Feeding him was a challenge.
"So what did you tell him?" she asked.
"Told him I'd think on it," answered Carl.
"I was getting ready to let 5 of them west acres go to weeds, you know. They're so choresome to keep the thistle out of."
"Don't sell," said Etta. "You do, you'll regret it, Carl."
"They're decent folks," answered Carl. "You can bet it'd be quiet over there, nobody carousing or carrying on.
Somebody you can work with when you have to. Better than a lot of other people that way.
He picked up his pipe and fiddled with it. He liked the feel of it in his hand.
Anyway, I told him I'd think on it, said Carl. Doesn't mean I have to sell to him, does it? Just means I'm going to think.
Think hard, warned Etta.
She got up and started in clearing the coffee things.
She felt willing to push and pull about this. 7 acres was near one quarter of the property, one quarter of their holdings.
That 7 will be worth plenty more later, she advised. You're better off keeping a good hold to it.
Maybe, said Carl.
I'll have to think about that, too.
Etta stood at the sink with her back to him. She did her dishes hard.
Sure be nice to have the money, though, wouldn't it? Carl said after a while. There's things we've been needing, and
if you're going to get onto that, Etta told him, it won't do any good by me. Don't try waving new church clothes at me, Carl. I can get myself clothes when I need them. We're not such paupers as to sell to Japs, are we? For new clothes? For a pouch of fancy pipe tobacco? I say you'd better keep hold of your land. Keep a tight hold, Carl, and a new frilly hat from Lottie's won't change that. Besides, she added, turning toward him now and wiping her hands on her apron, you think that man's got a treasure chest or something buried in the field somewhere? That's what you think? You think he's going to slap it down all at once in front of you or some such like, do you? He doesn't have a thing but what we give him for picking and what he gets cutting firewood for Torsons and those Catholic people, who are they, on South Beach by the pier. He doesn't have it, Carl. He's going to pay up 2 bits at a time, and you're going to carry it for pocket change to town. Pipe tobacco aplenty, magazines to read. Your 7 acres is going to be swallowed up by the dime store in Amity Harbor.
Them Catholic people is the Heplers, returned Carl. Miyamoto don't do any work for them anymore, I don't think. Last winter he cut cedar bolts for Torgerson, made good money, would be my guess. He works hard, Etta. You know that. You've seen him in the fields. Don't have to tell you that. He don't spend none of it, either. Eating sea perch all the time, big sack wholesale rice from Anacortes.
Carl scratched beneath his arm, massaged his chest with his thick, heavy fingers, picked up his pipe again and fiddled with it.
Miyamoto's live clean, he pressed on. You never been in their cabin? Person could eat off the floor in there. Kids sleep on mats. Somebody even been scrubbing mildew off the walls. Kids don't run around their faces all stained. Laundry all strung out neat with clothespins somebody carved. Don't wake up late, don't holler, don't complain, don't ask for nothing.
Like the Injuns do,
put in Etta.
Don't treat the Indians like dirt neither, Carl said. Kind to 'em. Showed 'em to the latrine. Showed them new ones the trail to the salt chuck. Showed 'em the best place for butter clams.
Now, said Carl, to me it don't make one bit of difference which way it is their eyes slant. I don't give a damn about that, Etta. People is people, comes down to it. And these are clean living people. Nothing wrong with them. So the question is, do we want to sell? Because Miyamoto, what he said, he's got 500 to put down now. 500. And the rest we can spread over 10 years.
Etta turned to her sink again. If this wasn't Carl all over, she thought. Liked to wander in his fields, chat with his pickers, taste his berries, smack his lips, smoke his pipe, go to town for a sack of nails. Put himself on the board for the Strawberry Festival Association, judged the floats, helped barbecue the salmon. Got himself all involved buying up the new fairgrounds, getting folks in Amity Harbor to donate lumber and whatnot for the dance pavilion at Westport Jensen. Joined the Masons and the Odd Fellows both. Helped out with the record-keeping at the Grange. Stood around evenings up at the pickers' cabins, jawing with the Japs and taking pains with the Indians, watching the women weave sweaters and such, drawing the men out on the subject of the old days before the strawberry farms went in.
Carl. Come end of picking season, he'd wander out to some old lonely place they told him about and look for arrowheads and bits of old bones, clamshell and whatnot. Once some old chief went with him. They came back with arrowheads and sat on the porch smoking pipes until 2 o'clock in the morning.
Carl gave the man rum to drink. She could hear them going at it from the bedroom, the both of them getting tipsy. She lay there with her eyes open and her ears tuned to the night, and listened to Carl and his chief do their rum, some horse laughs, all the while the chief telling stories about totem poles and canoes and an old potlatch he'd been to where some other chief's daughter had gotten married, and the old chief himself had won a spear-throwing contest, and the next day the other chief died suddenly in his sleep. Just like that he was dead, and his daughter married, and the others went and punched a hole in his canoe and stuck him in it and put it up in a tree for some god-awful reason. Edda had come to the door at 2 a.m. in her robe and told the chief to get on home. It was late. There were stars to walk by. She didn't like the smell of rum in her house. "Well," she said to Carl now, folding her arms in the kitchen doorway where she knew she would have the last word. "You're the man of the house. You wear the pants. Go ahead and sell our property to a Jap and see what comes of it." The arrangement, she explained at the behest of Alvin Hooks when the court had been called into session again, included a $500 down payment and an 8-year lease-to-own contract. Carl to collect $250 every 6 months, June 30th and December 31st, with 6.5% interest figured annually. Papers to be held by Carl, another set by Zenhichi, a third set for any inspector wanted to see them. The Miyamotos, this was back in 1934, said Etta, couldn't really own land anyway. They were from Japan, both of them born there, and there was this law on the books prevented them. Carl had kept the title in his own name, held it for them, called it a lease in case they got checked. She hadn't figured it. Carl had. She just kept track, was all. Watched the money come and go, made sure the interest was right. She didn't ever arrange no such thing. "One moment," Judge Fielding interrupted. He smoothed his robe and blinked at her. "Excuse me for interrupting, Mrs. Heine. The court has a few things to say about these matters. Pardon me for interrupting." "All right," said Etta. Judge Fielding nodded at her, then turned his attention toward the jury. "We'll skip all the whispering at the bench," he began. "Mr. Hooks and I might discuss matters for a bit, but if we did, no doubt it would come down to this. I'm going to have to interrupt the witness in order to explain a point of law." He rubbed his eyebrows, then drank some water. He put down his glass and began again. "The witness makes reference to a currently defunct statute of the state of Washington, which made it illegal, at the time of which she speaks, for an alien, a non-citizen, to hold title to real estate. This same statute, furthermore, stipulated that no person shall hold title for an alien, a non-citizen, in any way, shape, or form. Furthermore, in 1906, I believe it was, the U.S. Attorney General ordered all federal courts to deny naturalized citizenship to Japanese aliens. Thus it was impossible, in the strict legal sense, for Japanese immigrants to own land in Washington State. Mrs. Heine has told us that her deceased husband, in joint conspiracy with the defendant's deceased father, entered into an agreement which, shall we say, was predicated on a rather liberal, albeit mutually satisfying, interpretation of these laws. They quite simply made their way around them. At any rate, the witness's husband and the defendant's father entered into a so-called lease agreement that concealed an actual purchase. A substantial down payment changed hands. False papers were drawn up for state inspection. These papers, in fact, along with the others Mrs. Heine has described, the ones her husband and his buyer held, were entered, as you may recall, as state's evidence in this trial. The perpetrators of all this, as Mrs. Heine has taken pains to point out, are no longer among us, so their culpability is not at issue. If counsel or witness feel any further explanation is required, they may inquire further, the judge added. However, he said,
let it be known that this court is not concerned with any perpetrators of violations against our state's now, blessedly so, defunct alien land law. Mr. Hooks, you may proceed.
One thing, said Etta.
Yes, of course, the judge answered.
Them Japanese couldn't own land, said Etta. So I don't see how them Miyamotos could think they owned ours. They...
Mrs. Heine, said the judge, excuse me one more time. I apologize for interrupting, but I must remind you that Mr. Miyamoto here is on trial for murder in the first degree, that such is the focus of this court's concern, and that any contentiousness about legal ownership of land will have to be addressed in a civil court, madam. You will confine yourself, please, to answering the questions put to you. Mr. Hooks, said the judge, proceed.
Thank you, Alvin Hooks replied. For the record, let me point out that the witness has attempted only to reconstruct the facts about ownership of her land in direct response to a question put to her in the course of examination. That furthermore, such information is vital to the state's case, and that a clear portrait of the agreement between the defendant and the witness will illuminate the defendant's motive for committing murder.
That's enough, said Judge Fielding. You've made your opening statement, Alvin. Let's get on with it.
Alvin Hooks nodded and paced again.
Mrs. Heine, he said, let's back up just a moment. If the law, as you say, prevented the Miyamotos from owning land, what was the point of this sale agreement?
So they could make payments, said Etta.
The law let them own land if they were citizens. The Miyamoto kids were born here, so they're citizens, I guess. When they turned 20, the land would go over into their name. Law said they could do that, put it in their kid's name at 20.
I see, Alvin Hooks replied. And they, the defendant's family, the Miyamotos, that is, had no children in 1934 who were 20 years of age, Mrs. Heine, as far as you know, ma'am?
"'Oldest one's sitting right there,' said Etta, pointing a finger at Kabuo. "'He was 12, I believe, back then.'
Alvin Hooks turned to look at the defendant as though he was uncertain who she meant. "'The defendant?' he asked. "'In 34?'
"'Yes,' said Etta. "'The defendant. That's what the 8-year lease was all about. When 8 years was up, he'd be 20.'
"'In 42,' said Alvin Hooks.
"'42, that's right,' said Etta. November of 42, he'd be 20. They'd make the last payment December 31. The land'd go over into his name. That was going to be that.
Going to be? Said Alvin Hooks.
Missed the last payment, said Etta. Missed the last two payments, in fact. Never made them, the last two, out of 16 total.
She folded her arms across her chest. She set her mouth and waited. Nels Goodmanson coughed.
"'Now, Mrs. Heine,' said Hooks, "'when they missed two successive payments in 1942, "'what did you do about that?'
"'It took her a while to answer. "'She rubbed her nose. "'She adjusted her arms. "'She remembered how Carl had come home one afternoon "'with a posting he'd picked up in Amity Harbor. "'He'd sat at the table, smoothed it down in front of him, "'and read every word slowly. "'Etta had stood over him reading, too. Instructions to all persons of Japanese ancestry living in the following areas, it said. And then it listed Anacortes and Bellingham, San Juan and San Pedro, a lot of other places in the Skagit Valley. She forgot the others. At any rate, it told the Japs they had to leave by noon on March 29th. They were to be evacuated by the Fourth Army. Etta had counted on her fingers. The Japs had 8 days, exactly. They could bring bedding, linen, toilet articles, extra clothing, knives, spoons, forks, plates, bowls, cups. They had to tie it in neat bundles and put their names on everything. The government would give them a number. The Japs could bring what they could carry, but no pets. The government said it would store their furniture. The furniture would stay. The Japs had to report to an assembly center at the Amity Harbor dock on March 29th, 8 a.m. The government would provide transportation.
By
God, said Carl. He smoothed the bill with his thumb, shook his head.
Won't be pickers this year, replied Etta. Maybe get some Chinamen from Anacortes. The Japs aren't going to be around.
Plenty of time for that, said Carl. By God, Etta! He shook his head. Carl took his fingers from the bill on the table. It rolled up of its own accord. By God, he repeated. 8 days.
They'll be selling everything off, said Etta. Just you wait and see. All their knick-knacks, pots and pans, a lot of yard sales, you watch. That's what those people will do with their things. Sell them off as fast as they can to whoever'll take them off their hands.
People are going to take advantage, too, said Carl, still wagging his big head. He sat with his forearms on the table. Soon, she knew, he was going to eat something, spread crumbs across her kitchen. He looked as though he was ready to eat, as if he was contemplating food.
It's too bad, he said. It ain't right.
They're Japs, answered Etta. We're in a war with them. We can't have spies around.
Carl shook his head and, heavy as he was, swiveled in his chair to face her. We ain't right together, he told Etta flatly. You and me. We just ain't right. She knew, indeed, what he meant by that. But just the same, she didn't answer. Anyway, he had said this sort of thing before. It didn't hurt very much. For a moment, Etta stood with her wrists against her hips, letting him know how she felt about matters, but Carl didn't look away.
Have some Christian compassion, he said. My grace, Etta, don't you feel nothing?
She went out. There was weeding to be done, and she had to fill the hog trough. She stopped in the mudroom, hung her apron on a hook, sat down to pull her boots on. She was sitting there like that, struggling with a boot, worrying over what Carl had said, the two of them not being right for each other, that old thing, when Zenichi Miyamoto came to the door, took his hat off and nodded.
We heard, she said, about you people. Is Mr. Heine home, Mrs. Heine?
Miyamoto propped his hat against his leg, but then he shifted it behind his back.
He's here, said Etta. Yes.
She stuck her head around the mudroom door and called loudly for Carl.
Someone's here, she added.
When Carl showed, she said to him, You may as well talk about it right here in front of me. I'm a part of this.
Hello, Zenichi, said Carl. Why don't you come on in?
Etta pried her boots off. She followed the Jap into the kitchen.
Sit down, Zenichi, Carl said. Etta, we'll get you some coffee.
He stared at her, and she nodded. She took a fresh apron from its hook and put it on. She filled the coffee pot.
We saw the posting, said Carl. 8 days just isn't near enough time. How can a body be ready in 8 days? It ain't right, he added. It just ain't right.
What can we do? Zenichi said. We will put boards with nails on our windows. Leave everything. If you will like, Mr. Heine, you can work our fields. We are grateful that you have sold them to us. Good 2-year plants now, most. We will have plenty berries. You pick them, please. Sell them to the cannery. Keep what money? Otherwise they rot, Mr. Heine, and nobody gets nothing.
Carl began to scratch his face. He sat across from Zenichi, scratching. He looked large and coarse, the Japanese man smaller and clear-eyed. They were about the same age, but the Jap looked younger, 15 years younger at least. Etta put cups and saucers on the table, opened the sugar bowl. Pretty shrewd for openers, she thought. Offer the berries. They're worth nothing to him now. Real clever. Then talk about payments.
I'm obliged, said Carl. We'll pick them, then. I'm much obliged, Zenichi.
The Japanese man nodded. He was always nodding, thought Etta. It was how they got the better of you. They acted small, thought big. Nod, say nothing, keep their faces turned down. It was how they got things like her 7 acres.
"How are you going to make your payments if me and Carl's picking your berries?" she asked from her place by the stove. "It's not—"
"Just hold on now, Etta," Carl broke in. "We don't need to talk about that just yet."
He turned his attention back to the Jap.
"How is everyone to home?" he said. "How's everyone taking it?"
"Very busy at home," said Miyamoto, "packing everything, making ready." He smiled. She saw his big teeth.
"Can we help somehow?" said Carl.
"You pick our berries. That is big help."
"But can we help? Can we do something else?"
Etta brought the coffee pot to the table. She saw that Miyamoto had his hat in his lap. Well, Carl was being a real gracious host, but he'd forgotten about that, hadn't he? The Jap had to sit there with his hat under the table like a man who'd wet his pants.
"Carl will pour," she announced. She sat down, smoothed her apron. She folded her hands on the tabletop.
"Let it sit a minute," answered Carl. "Then we'll have our coffee."
They were sitting there like that when Carl Jr. barged through the kitchen door. Home from school already. 3:35 and home already. Must have run or something. Had one book with him, mathematics. His jacket was grass-stained, his face ruddy with the wind, a little sweaty, too. She could see he was hungry, like his father that way, ate everything in sight. "There's some apples in the pantry," she pointed out. "You may get one, Carl. Get a glass of milk and go outside. Somebody's here. We're talking."
"I heard about it," said Carl Jr. "I—"
"Go on and get your apple," said Etta. "Somebody's here, Carl." He went. He came back with two apples. Went to the refrigerator, took out the milk pitcher, poured himself a glass of milk. His father reached for the coffee pot and filled Miyamoto's cup, then Etta's, then his own. Carl Jr. looked at them, the apples in one hand, the glass of milk in the other. He went on into the living room. "You go outside," called Etta. "Don't you eat in there." The boy came back and stood in the doorway. There was a bite taken out of one of the apples. The milk was gone from his glass. He was already near as big as his father. He was 18. It was hard to believe how big he was. He took another bite from the apple. "Is Kabuo home?" he asked.
"Kabuo just home," replied Miyamoto.
"Yes, he is there." He smiled.
"I'm going over," said Carl Jr.
He walked across the kitchen and put his glass in the sink. He banged out through the kitchen door.
"Come back for your school book," Etta called.
The boy came back and took his book up the stairs. He went into the pantry, got another apple, waved as he went by them. "I'll be back," he announced. Carl pushed the sugar bowl toward the Japanese man.
"Take some," he said. "Cream, too, if you like."
Miyamoto nodded.
"Thank you," he said. "Very good. Sugar only, please."
He stirred in half a spoon of sugar. He used his spoon carefully, set it in his saucer. He waited until Carl picked up his cup, then picked up his own and sipped.
"Very good," he said.
He looked over at Etta and smiled her way, a little smile. That was all he ever gave.
"Your boy is very big now," he said.
He was still smiling. And then he lowered his head.
"I want to make payment. Two more payment, everything done. Today I have $120.
Carl Sr. was shaking his head. He put his coffee down, shook his head some more.
"Absolutely not," he said. "Absolutely not, Zenichi. We'll get your harvest in, see what comes of that July. Maybe then we can work out something. Maybe where you're going they'll have work for you to do. Who knows? It'll turn out. Point is, though, no way am I going to take your savings off your hands at a time like this, Zenichi. Don't even talk about that now."
The Jap put his $120 on the table. A lot of tens, some fives, 10 ones. He spread them out in a fan.
"You take this, please," he said.
"I send more from where I am going. Make payment. Maybe payment is not enough. You still have 7 acres strawberries this year. Then December there is one more payment. You see, one more."
Etta folded her arms across her chest. She knew he wasn't giving his strawberries for nothing. "Your berries," she said. "What can we figure? After all, nobody sets the price till June."
"All right, say you've got good plants, two-year plants, like you say you do. Everything goes right. We get people in there weeding, no spit bugs, good sun, everything comes out right, berries come in, good crop. All right, after labor and what we put into fertilizer, maybe you've got 200 worth of berries in a good year, if the price is good, if everything goes right. But let's just say it's a bad year, an average year. Fungus gets 'em, too much rain, any one of a dozen things. Now we're talking about 100, maybe 120 worth of berries, okay? What then? I'll tell you what, it won't be enough to cover your payment, $250.
"You take this," said Zenhichi. He made a stack of the bills, moved them toward her. "This $120. Strawberries bring 130, next payment is made."
"Thought you was giving the berries," said Etta. "Didn't you come in here giving them away? Didn't you tell us to sell them to the cannery and keep whatever comes from that? Now what you want is 130.
She reached out and took his neat stack of bills, counted the money while she spoke.
130 on the risk they bring it, plus this here as an early payment, the risk in exchange for getting this March instead of us waiting on all of it till June. Is that what you came here hoping on?"
The Japanese man blinked at her steadily. He said nothing. Didn't touch his coffee, either. He'd gone rigid, gone cold. She could see that he was angry, that he was holding it in, not exposing his rage. "He's proud," she thought. "I just spit on him. He's pretending it didn't happen that way. Blink away," she thought. Etta finished counting his money, set the stack of bills back on the table, and folded her arms across her chest again.
"More coffee?"
she asked.
"No, thank you," the Jap replied. "You take money, please."
Carl's big hand slid across the table. His fingers covered the stack of bills and pushed it in front of the Jap's coffee.
"Zenhichi," he said, "we won't take this. Don't matter what Etta says, we won't. She's been rude to you, and I apologize for that."
He looked at her then, and she looked right back. She knew how he felt. But it didn't matter very much. She wanted Carl to know what was up, how he was being duped. She wasn't going to hang her head. She stared back at him.
"I am sorry," the Jap said. "Very sorry."
"We'll worry about this come picking season," said Carl. "You get where you're going, you write to us. We'll get your berries in, right back, we'll go from there. We'll just play this by ear a little bit, far as I'm concerned. One way or another, you get your payments finished, maybe down the road somewhere, everything comes out like it should in the long run."
"Everything comes out satisfactory, but right now you've got deeper things to think about. You don't need us bending your ear about payments, you've got plenty to do without that. And anything I can do, help you get your things all ready, you let me know, Zenhichi."
"I make payments," Zenhichi answered. "I find a way. I send you."
"That's fine," said Carl, and put his hand out.
The Japanese man took it.
"Thank you, Carl," he said. "I make payments. No worry."
Etta watched Zenhichi. It occurred to her that he had not grown old. She noticed this more clearly than ever. For 10 years he'd been working these very same fields. His eyes were still clear, his back was straight, his skin was taut, his belly remained lean and hard. 10 years he had worked in the same fields she had, and yet he hadn't aged a day. His clothes were clean, his head erect, his complexion brown and healthy. And all of this was part of his mystery, his distance from what she was. Something he knew about kept him from aging while she, Etta, grew worn and weary. Something he knew about yet kept to himself, bottled up behind his face. Maybe it was Jap religion, she thought, or maybe it was in his blood. There didn't seem any way to know. She remembered on the witness stand that Carl Jr. had returned that evening with a bamboo fishing rod.
how he had looked to her coming through the door with his hair rumpled by the wind, how big and young, like a Great Dane puppy, bounding into her kitchen. Her son, a big young man. "Look at this," he'd said to her. "Kabuo loaned it to me." He began to explain it to her. She'd been at the sink, peeling supper potatoes. He said it was a good rod for sea-run cutthroat. Split bamboo, made by a Mr. Nishi, the ferrules smooth, silk-wrapped. Figured he'd go trolling with it, get Eric Everts or somebody, one of his friends, to take him out in a canoe. Rig it up with light tackle, see how it played. Where was Dad? He'd go show it to him. Etta didn't stop peeling her potatoes while she said to her son what she had to say. Take the fishing rod back to the Japs. They owed them money. The rod confused that. She remembered how the boy had looked at her, hurt and trying to hide it. Wanted to argue, didn't want to argue, wouldn't win and already knew it. The look of the defeated, his father's look. Big, plodding strawberry farmer. Subdued, pinned to the earth. The boy spoke like his father and moved like his father, but he had a broad brow, small ears. There was a set to his eyes, some of her in him. The boy was not all Carl's. Her son, too, she felt that. "You turn around and take it right on back," she'd said again, and pointed with the peeler, and in this she saw now, on the witness stand, her feelings had not been wrong. He'd taken the rod back. Some months had passed. He'd gone to the war. He'd come on home. That Japanese boy had killed him. She'd been right about them all along. Carl, her husband, had been wrong. "They didn't meet their payments," she told Alvin Hooks. "Simple as that. Didn't meet them. She sold the place off to old Jurgensen. Sent their equity on down to them in California. Didn't try to hold back their money. Gave every penny back." She moved into Amity Harbor, Christmas time, 44. That was that, she'd figured. Looked now like she was wrong about one thing. You were never shut of people where money was concerned. One way or another, they wanted. And on account of that, she told the court, her son had been murdered by Kabuo Miyamoto. Her son was dead and gone. Chapter 10. Alvin Hooks skirted the edge of his table and resumed the slow, fluid pacing of the floorboards that had been part of his strategy all morning. "Mrs. Heine," he said, "in December of 44 you moved to Amity Harbor?"
"That's right."
"Your husband had recently passed away?"
"That's right, too."
"You felt that without him you couldn't work your land?"
"Yes."
"So you moved to Amity Harbor," said Alvin Hooks. "Where exactly, Mrs. Heine?"
"On Main Street," said Etta, "up above Lottie Opsvig's shop."
"Lottie Opsvig's, an apparel shop?"
"That's right."
"In an apartment?"
"Yes."
"A big apartment?"
"No,"
said Etta,
"just one bedroom."
"One bedroom above an apparel shop," said Alvin Hooks. "So you took a one-bedroom apartment, then, and may I ask about your monthly rent?"
$25, said Etta.
"A $25-a-month apartment," Alvin Hooks said. "You're still living there? You currently reside there?"
"Yes."
"Still paying $25?
"No," said Etta. "$35. Price has gone up since 44.
"44, Alvin Hooks repeated. "The year you moved in? The year you sent the Miyamotos their equity and came to live in Amity Harbor?"
"Yes," said Etta.
"Mrs. Heine," said Alvin Hooks, and stopped pacing. "Did you hear again from the Miyamotos after that, after you sent them their money?"
"I heard from them," said Etta.
"When was that?" Alvin Hooks asked. Etta bit her lip and thought it over. She squeezed her cheeks between her fingers. "It was July of 45, she answered finally. "That one there showed up at my door." And she pointed at Kabuo Miyamoto. "The defendant?"
"Yes."
"He came to your door in 1945? To your apartment door in Amity Harbor?"
That's right.
Did he call ahead? Were you expecting him?
No. Just showed up. Just like that.
Just showed up unannounced? Out of nowhere, as it were?
That's right,
replied Etta. Out of nowhere. Mrs. Heine, said the prosecutor, what did the defendant indicate was the nature of his business with you?
He wanted to talk about land, he said. Had a few things to say about my land I sold to all.
Exactly what did he say, Mrs. Heine? Can you remember, for the benefit of the court?
Etta folded her hands in her lap and glanced at Kabuo Miyamoto. She could see in his eyes, they didn't fool her, that he remembered everything. He'd stood in her doorway, neatly dressed, his hands clasped, unblinking. It was July, and the heat in her apartment was unbearable. The doorway felt much cooler. They'd stared at each other, and then Etta had folded her arms across her chest and asked him what he wanted. "Mrs. Heine," he'd said, "do you remember me?"
"Course I do," Etta had answered.
She hadn't seen him since the day the Japs left, more than 3 years before, in 42, but she recollected him clearly enough. He was the boy who'd tried to give Carl a fishing rod. The boy she used to see from her kitchen window, practicing in the fields with his wooden sword. He was the oldest of the Miyamoto children. She knew his face but didn't remember his name. The one her son used to hang around with.
"I've been back home 3 days," he'd said. "I guess Carl isn't home yet."
"Carl's passed on," replied Etta. "Carl Jr.'s fighting the Japs." She stared at the man in the doorway. "They're just about licked," she added.
"Just about," Kabuo had replied. He unclasped his hands and put them at his back. "I was sorry to hear about Mr. Heine," he said. "I heard about it in Italy. My mother sent me a letter."
"Well, I told you people about it when I sent on down the equity," returned Etta. "Said in my letter Carl had passed on and that I'd had to go and sell the place."
"Yes," said Kabuo. "But Mrs. Heine, my father had an agreement with Mr. Heine, didn't he?
Didn't—" "Mr. Heine was passed away," Etta interrupted. "I had to make a decision. Couldn't farm the place myself, could I? I sold to all, and that's that," she said. "You want to talk about that piece of land, you're going to have to talk to all. I don't have nothing to do with it."
"Please," replied Kabuo. "I talked to Mr. Jurgensen already. I got back to the island just last Wednesday and went out to see what had become of the place. You know, have a look around. Mr. Jurgensen was out there, up on his tractor. We talked for a while about things."
"Well, good," said Etta. "So you talked to him?"
"I talked to him," said Kabuo.
"He said I'd better talk to you."
Etta folded her arms more tightly.
"Hmph," she said. "It's his land, isn't it? Go on back and tell him that. Tell him I said so. You tell him."
"He didn't know," said Kabuo.
"You didn't tell him we were one payment away, Mrs. Heine. You didn't tell him Mr. Heine had—"
"He didn't know," sneered Etta. "Is that what all told you?
He didn't know. Is that it? Was I supposed to say, 'All, there's these folks made a illegal agreement with my husband, hands over 7 acres to them'? Is that what I was supposed to say?"
"He didn't know," repeated Etta. "Most ridiculous thing I ever heard. I'm supposed to tell someone's buying up my land there's an illegal contract muddling matters up? And what if I did, huh? Fact is, you people didn't meet your payments. That's a fact. And just suppose you'd done that to a bank round here. Just suppose. You don't make your payments. What do you think happens? Somebody waits real polite on you? No. Bank repossesses your land. That's what happens. I haven't done anything a bank wouldn't do. I haven't done anything wrong."
"You haven't done anything illegal," the Jap replied. "Wrong is a different matter."
Etta blinked. She stepped back and put her hand on the doorknob.
"Get out of here," she said. "You sold our land," the Jap continued. "You sold our land out from under us, Mrs. Heine. You took advantage of the fact that we were gone. You—"
But she'd shut the door so as not to listen.
"Carl made such a mess," she'd thought. "Now I have to clean it all up."
"Mrs. Heine," said the prosecutor, Alvin Hooks, when she'd finished telling of these things, "did you see the defendant thereafter? Did he approach you again about these land matters?"
"Did I see him? asked Etta. "Sure I saw him. Saw him in town, saw him at Peterson's, here and there. I saw him now and again, yes."
"Did he speak to you?"
"No."
"Ever?"
"No."
"There was no further communication between you?"
"None I can think of, unless you want to call dirty looks a way of speaking." And she glanced at Kabuo again.
"Dirty looks, Mrs. Heine. What exactly do you mean?"
Etta smoothed the front of her dress and sat more erectly in the witness stand. "Every time I saw him," she insisted, "there he'd be with his eyes narrowed at me, you know, watching, glaring."
"I see," said the prosecutor.
"And how long did this continue?"
"Been going on ever since," said Etta. "Never stopped. I never saw a sociable look from him, not once in all the times I saw him, always narrowing his eyes at me, giving me his mean face."
"Mrs. Heine," said Alvin Hooks, "did you ever have a conversation with your son about the defendant in this regard? Did you tell Carl Jr. that Kabuo Miyamoto had come to your door and argued with you about the sale of your family's land?"
"My son knew all about it. When he got back, I told him."
"Got back?"
"From the war," said Etta. "A couple months later, about October, I think it was."
"And you told him then the defendant had come to your door?"
"Yes."
"Do you recall his response?"
"Yes," said Etta. "He said he'd keep an eye on it. Said that if Kabuo Miyamoto was giving me dirty looks, he'd keep an eye on him."
"I see," said Alvin Hooks.
"And did he?"
"Yes, as far as I know, yes."
"He kept an eye out for Kabuo Miyamoto?"
"Yes, he did. He watched for him."
"To your knowledge, Mrs. Heine, were the two of them on unfriendly terms? They were both fishermen. They shared that in common. They were, as you have said, neighbors in adolescence, and yet there was this dispute, this family dispute over land. So were they, the defendant and your son, on friendly or unfriendly terms from 1945 on?"
"No," said Etta. "The defendant wasn't no friend of my son's. Isn't that obvious? They were enemies."
"Enemies?" said Alvin Hooks.
"Carl told me more'n once he wished Kabuo would forget about his 7 acres and stop looking at me cross-eyed."
"When you told him the defendant had given you dirty looks, your son reacted exactly how, Mrs. Heine?"
"Said he wished Kabuo would stop doing that. Said he'd have to keep an eye out for Kabuo."
"Keep an eye out," Alvin Hooks repeated.
"He saw some danger from Mr. Miyamoto?"
"Objection," cut in Nels Goodmanson. "The witness is being asked to speculate as to her son's state of mind and his emotional status. He's..."
All right," said Alvin Hooks.
"Tell us what you observed, Mrs. Heine. Tell us what your son said or did. Was there anything to suggest he saw some kind of danger from Kabuo Miyamoto?"
"Said he'd keep an eye out for him," repeated Etta. "You know, he'd watch out."
"Did your son say he felt he had to watch for Mr. Miyamoto, that there was danger from him of some kind?"
"Yes," said Etta. "He kept an eye on him. Every time I told him that man was glaring at me, that's what he said. He'd watch out."
"Mrs. Heine," said Alvin Hooks,
"do you think that the term family feud could be accurately applied to the relationship between your family and that of the defendant? Were you enemies? Was there a feud?"
Etta looked directly at Kabuo.
"Yes," she said.
"We're enemies, all right. They've been bothering us over those 7 acres for near 10 years now. My son was killed over it."
"Objection," said Nels Goodmanson. "The witness is speculating as to..."
"Sustained," agreed Judge Fielding. "Witness will confine herself to answering questions put to her without further speculation. I hereby instruct you jury members to disregard her last words. Witness's comment will furthermore be struck from the record. Let's move on, Mr. Hooks."
"Thank you," Alvin Hooks said.
"But I can't think of anything else I want to ask, Your Honor."
"Mrs. Heine, I want you to know that I appreciate your coming down, though, what with this weather we've been having. Thank you for testifying in a snowstorm." He swiveled now on the toe of one shoe. He pointed a forefinger at Nels Goodmanson. "You're a witness," he said. Nels Goodmanson shook his head and frowned.
"Just three questions," he grumbled without getting up. "I've done some calculating, Mrs. Heiner. If I've multiplied correctly, the Miyamoto family purchased 7 acres from you for $4,500. Is that right? $4,500?
"Tried to buy it for that much," said Etta. "Never finished their payments."
"Second question," Nell said. "When you went to old Jurgensen in 1944 and told him you wanted to sell him your land, what was the price per acre?"
"$1,000," said Etta. "$1,000 per acre."
"I guess that makes what would have been $4,500 into $7,000 instead, doesn't it? A $2,500 increase in the land's value if you sent the Miyamotos their equity and sold the land to old Jurgensen."
"Is that your third question?" said Etta.
"It is," said Nels. "Yes."
"You done your math right. $2,500.
"That's all, then, thank you," Nels replied. "You may step down, Mrs. Heiner."
Old Jurgensen came out of the gallery leaning hard on his cane. Alvin Hooks held the swinging door for him, and Old shuffled past with his cane in his right hand and his left at the small of his back. He shuffled half sidewise, an injured crab, making his way toward where Ed Soames stood proffering the Holy Bible. When Ole arrived, he bobbled his cane from hand to hand before settling on the expediency of hanging it from his wrist. The stroke he'd suffered in June caused his hands to tremble. He'd been out among his pickers, sorting berries in a bin, when the sensation that the earth was tilting under his feet grew on him out of a more general dizziness and nausea that had inhabited him all morning. Ole reared up and made a last desperate effort to shrug off what was happening, but the sky seemed to crowd around his head, the earth buckled, and he keeled over into a strawberry bin. There he lay, blinking up at the clouds until two Canadian Indian pickers pulled him out by the armpits. They took him up to his house in the tractor bucket and laid him on his porch like a corpse. Liesel shook him until he grunted at her and drooled, and in the face of this she began a hysterical interrogation into the nature of his symptoms. When it became apparent he didn't intend to answer, she stopped talking and kissed his forehead. Then she hurried in and called Dr. Whaley. Since then he had withered rapidly. His legs were stilts, his eyes leaked water, his beard ended in wisps at the third button of his vest. His skin appeared pink and chafed. He perched in the stand, both hands wrapped around the head of his cane now, a tremulous and gangling old man. "Mr. Jurgensen," Alvin Hooks began, "you were for many years a neighbor of the Heine family in Center Valley, is that correct, sir?"
"Yes,"
said old Jurgensen. "How many years?"
"Just always," said old. "Why, I can remember back 40 years to when Carl, old Carl, cleared his land next to mine."
40 years, said Alvin Hooks. "For 40 years you were a berry farmer?"
"Yes, sir, more than 40.
"How many acres did you own, Mr. Jurgensen?" Ole seemed to think about it. He licked his lips and squinted at the courthouse ceiling. His hands roamed up and down the length of his cane.
35 start out," he said. "Then I acquired 30 more from Etta, you see, like Etta tell before when she was up here. So that brought me up to 65 acre. Big farm it was."
"Yes," said Alvin Hooks. "So you purchased 30 acres from Etta Heiner, then?"
"Yes, sir, I did so."
"And when was that, Mr. Jurgensen?"
"Just like she tell, 1944.
"She handed over to you the property deed at that time?"
"Yes, sir."
"In your mind, Mr. Jurgensen, did the deed read free and clear? That is, were there any encumbrances or conditions, easements, liens, that sort of thing?"
"No," said old Jurgensen. "No thing like that. The contract was good. Everything looked right with it."
"I see," said Alvin Hooks.
So you were not aware of any claim, then, that the Miyamotos might have had to any seven of your newly purchased 30 acres?
Not aware, no, said Ol. I bring it up with Etta, you see, because the Miyamoto family, they have a house on the property. I know 7 acres has been sold to them, but Etta says to me they don't make no payment, so she is to repossess. She don't have any choice after Carl passed away, says she. Everything looks good with the contract, says she. The Miyamoto family away in the camp, says she. Maybe they won't come back. She is going to give them their money, says she. They don't have any claim, no, sir.
So you heard nothing about any claim the Miyamotos might have had to 7 acres of your newly purchased land?
No, I hear nothing about it until that man,
he aimed his nose at the defendant,
come round about and tell me.
Do you mean the defendant there, Kabuo Miyamoto?
Him, said Ol. Yes, that's right.
He came around when, Mr. Jurgensen?
Let's see, said Ol. He come summer of 45, he does. He shows up at my place and say, Mrs. Heine robbed him. Mr. Heine never would have let no such thing like that happen, he says.
I'm not following, said Alvin Hooks. The defendant showed up at your farm in the summer of 1945 and accused Etta Heine of robbing him?
Yes, sir, that's what I remember.
And what did you say?
I say no to him. She sell the land to me, and I don't see his name any place on the contract.
Yes?
He wants to know, will I sell it back to him?
Sell it back? Said Alvin Hooks. The 30 acres?
He don't want all 30, answered Ol. He just want the 7 in the northwest where his family was one time living before the war.
And did you talk about that? Did you consider selling?
He didn't have no money, said Ol. Anyway, I'm not thinking of selling then. It was before my stroke. I had a good farm, 65 acres. I don't want to sell one piece to anybody.
Mr. Jurgensen, said Alvin Hooks, when you purchased Etta Heine's 30 acres, did you acquire her home as well?
No, she sold it separate. Just the house to Bjorn Andreasen, and he is still living there now.
And the house the defendant's family had lived in, Mr. Jurgensen?
This one, said Ol, I bought.
I see, said Alvin Hooks. And what did you do with it?
I use it for my pickers, you see, said Ol. My farm was so big now, I need to have a manager with me year-round, so he is living there, plus room for pickers come picking time.
Mr. Jurgensen, Alvin Hooks said, did the defendant say anything else to you during his visit in the summer of 1945? Anything you can remember? Old Jurgensen's right hand left the head of his cane. It clawed its way into the side pocket of his coat and fumbled about for something.
Yes, one thing, said Ol. He said some day he would get his land back.
That he would get it back?
Yes, sir. And he is angry.
And what did you say?
I said to him, why is he angry to me? I don't know anything about this land except that I don't want to sell it to nobody.
Ol lifted a handkerchief to his mouth and dried his lips with it.
I say to him, go talk with Etta Heine. She is moved into Amity Harbor. I tell him where he can look for her. She is the person to talk to.
And did he leave then?
Yes.
And did you see him again?
I see him, yes. This island is small. You live hereabouts, you see everybody.
All right, Alvin Hooks said. You've had a stroke, Mr. Jurgensen, as you say, and that was in June of this year?
Yes, sir, June 28th.
I see, said Alvin Hooks. And it incapacitated you so that you felt you could no longer run your farm? Old Jurgensen didn't answer at first. His right hand, with the handkerchief in it, returned to the head of his cane. He chewed on the inside of his cheek. His head shook. Ol struggled to speak. Yes, he said. I just couldn't do it, you see.
You couldn't run your farm?
No.
So what did you do?
I put it on the market for sale, said old Jurgensen. September 7th, just after Labor Day.
Of this year?
Yes, sir.
Did you list your property with a real estate agent, Mr. Jurgensen?
Yes, sir.
With Klaus Hartmann?
Yes, sir.
Did you advertise in any other way?
We had a sign on the barn, said Ole. That was everything.
And what happened then? Asked Alvin Hooks. Did anybody come to look?
Karl Heine came, said Ole. Karl Heine, Etta's son.
When was that? Alvin Hooks asked.
That was September 7th, said Ole. Round about comes Karl Heine, wanting to buy my farm.
Tell us about that, Alvin Hooks asked gently. Karl Heine was a successful fisherman. He owned a fine place on Mill Run Road. What did he want with your farm? Old Jurgensen blinked half a dozen times. He dabbed at his eyes with his handkerchief. The young man, he remembered, Carl Jr., had driven into his yard that morning, in a sky-blue Bel Air, scattering chickens before him. Ole, from his place on the porch, knew who it was immediately. He guessed what it was he wanted. The young man had come by each picking season. He'd brought along his wife and children. They'd taken their caddies into the fields and picked berries together. Ole had always refused Carl's money, but Carl had pressed it on him. When Ole shook his head, Carl put the bills on the weighing table next to the scales beneath a stone. "Don't care if it was my father's land once," he'd say. "It's yours now. We'll pay." Now here he was, big like his father, with his father's stature and his mother's face, dressed like a fisherman in rubber boots. He was a fisherman, Ole recalled, had named his boat after his wife, the Susan Marie. Liesel had given the young man a glass of iced tea. He'd sat down so that from where they looked, the strawberry fields spread out before them. Way in the distance, they could just make out the broad side of Bjorn Andreasen's house, where Carl Jr. had once lived. Small talk, Ole explained now to the court. Carl had asked about the strawberries this year. Ole had asked about the salmon runs. Liesel had inquired as to Etta's health, and then she had asked Carl how the fishing life suited him. It doesn't, Carl had answered. It had been, thought Ole, an odd thing for the young man to say aloud. It must have hurt his pride to say it. He'd been admitting something. Ole understood, and admitting it for a reason. He'd wanted to make a point. The young man had put his glass down, just in front of his rubber boots, and leaned toward them, his elbows on his knees, as if he was about to confess something. He'd looked at the floorboards of the porch for a moment. "I want to buy your farm," he'd said. Liesel had explained to him how Bjorn Andreasen had the old Heine house. There was nothing to be done about it. Liesel had explained that she and Ole didn't want to leave the farm at all, but there was nothing to be done about that either. And the young man had nodded and scratched the bristles along his jaw. "I'm sorry for that," he'd said quietly. "I feel bad to take advantage of your health, Mr. Jurgensen, but if you have to sell, I guess, well, I'm interested." Ole had said, "I am happy. You have lived here. You know this place. We do what is fair. I am happy." And he'd reached his hand toward the young man. The young man took it solemnly. "It's the way I feel, too," he'd said. They'd spoken in the kitchen of the arrangements they would make together. Carl's money was tied up in the Susan Marie and in his house on Mill Run Road. In the meantime, there was $1,000 in earnest money. Carl put it on the table. 10 $100 bills. Come November, the boat would sell, then the house, said Carl. Your wife will be happy, said Liesel with a smile. Fishermen are always gone at night. Old Jurgensen leaned on his cane and remembered another visitor later that same day. Kabuo Miyamoto had come to see him.
"The defendant?" asked Alvin Hooks. "On September 7th of this year?"
"Yes, sir,"
said O. "The same day Carl Heine came to see you to inquire about the sale of your land?"
"Yes, sir."
"In the afternoon of that same day?"
"Round about lunch," said O.
"We were just about sitting down to lunch, it was. Miyamoto knocked on our door."
"And did he say, Mr. Jurgensen, what he wanted?"
"Same as Etta's son," said O. "He wanted to buy my land."
"Tell us about that," said Alvin Hooks. "What exactly did he say to you?"
They'd sat down on the porch together, explained Ole.
The defendant had seen the sign on the barn and wanted to buy Ole's farm. Ole had remembered the Japanese man's promise, how he'd stood in the fields and vowed that one day he would get his family's land back. The Japanese man had slipped his mind altogether. 9 years had passed. He'd remembered, too, that the Japanese man had worked for him years before, part of a crew that put in his raspberries in 1939. Ole remembered him pounding home cedar posts for raspberry canes, standing in the bed of a pickup truck, shirtless, swinging a maul. He must have been 16 or 17. He remembered seeing him early in the morning, too, swinging a wooden sword in the fields. The boy's father, he remembered, was Zinichi, something like that. He never could pronounce it. On the porch he'd asked Kabuo about his father, but the man had long passed away. The Japanese man had asked about the land then and asserted his wish to buy the 7 acres his family had once held.
"I'm afraid it isn't for sale," Liesel had said. "It's already been sold, you see. Somebody else came by this morning, I'm sorry to tell you, Kabuo."
"Yes," said O, "we're sorry."
The Japanese man had stiffened. In a moment the politeness went from his face so that Ole could no longer read him.
"It's sold?" he said. "Already?"
"Yes," said Liesel. "Just like that. We're sorry to disappoint you."
"All of it?" asked the Japanese man.
"Yes," said Liesel. "We're very sorry. We didn't even have time to take our sign down."
The stiff expression of Kabuo Miyamoto's face didn't change even for a second.
"Who bought it?" he said. "I want to talk to them."
"Etta Heine's son, Carl," said Liesel. "He came by around 10 o'clock.
"Carl Heine,"
the Japanese man answered, with a hint of anger in his voice. Ole had suggested that Kabuo Miyamoto go to see Carl Heine about the matter. Perhaps something could be worked out.
Liesel shook her head and wrung her hands in her apron.
"We've sold it," she'd repeated apologetically. "Ole and Carl shook hands, you see. We accepted earnest money. We're bound to our agreement. It's sold, you see. We're sorry."
The Japanese man had stood then.
"I should have come earlier," he said.
The next day Carl had come by again. Liesel phoned him about Kabuo Miyamoto, to take the sign down from the barn. Ole, leaning on his cane, stood below and told him about the Japanese man's visit. Carl, he remembered, had been interested in the details of it. He nodded his head and listened closely. Ole Jurgensen told everything, the way the politeness had gone out of the Japanese man, the unreadable Japanese expression on his face when he heard that the land he coveted had been sold. Carl Heine nodded again and again, and then came down from the ladder with the sign.
"Thanks for telling me," he'd said.
Chapter 11
After the noon recess was called that day, Kabuo Miyamoto ate lunch in his cell, as he had 77 times. The cell was one of two in the courthouse basement, and had neither bars nor windows. It was big enough for a low military surplus bunk, a toilet, a sink, and a nightstand. There was a drain in the corner of its concrete floor and a foot-square grate in its door. Other than this, there were no openings or apertures through which light could seep. A naked bulb hung overhead, and Kabuo could turn it on and off by screwing and unscrewing it in its socket. Yet before the first week was over, he discovered in himself a preference for darkness. His eyes adjusted to it.
He was less troubled by the closeness of his cell walls, with the naked light put out, less conscious that he was jailed. Kabuo sat on the edge of his bunk with his lunch perched in front of him on the nightstand. A peanut butter and jelly sandwich, 2 carrot sticks, a mound of lime gelatin, a tin cup of milk, served on a cafeteria tray. At this particular moment his light was on. He'd turned it on in order to see what he was eating, but also in order to look at his face in a handheld shaving mirror. His wife had said he looked like one of Tojo's soldiers. He wanted to see if this was so. He sat with his tray just in front of his knees, confronting his reflection in the hand mirror. He could see how his face had once been a boy's face, and how on top of this was laid the face of his war years. A face he was no longer surprised to see, though it had astonished him greatly in the beginning. He had come home from the war and seen in his own eyes the disturbed, empty reaches he'd seen in the eyes of other soldiers he'd known. They did not so much seem to stare right through things as to stare past the present state of the world into a world that was permanently in the distance for them, and at the same time more immediate than the present. Kabuo remembered much in this manner. Under the surface of his daily life was a life he lived as if underwater. Kabuo remembered how under the helmet of the soldier on the wooded hillside, underneath the steady droning of the bees, it had turned out to be a very young boy he had shot directly through the groin. When Kabuo approached from one side, the boy had stared up at him and spoke through clenched teeth in tremulous German. Then the boy panicked and moved his hand toward his gun, and Kabuo shot him one more time in the heart at point-blank range. Yet still the boy refused to die, and lay on his back between 2 trees while Kabuo stood 5 feet away, frozen, his rifle shouldered still. The boy held his chest in both of his hands and exerted himself to raise his head from the ground, at the same time gathering himself to take a breath and sucked in the hot afternoon air. Then he spoke again, between his teeth, and it was clear to Kabuo that he was begging, pleading, that he wanted the American who had killed him to save him. He had no choice but to ask him for this. Nobody else was present. All of it was too much, and when the boy stopped talking, his chest twitched a half dozen times, and blood ran from his mouth and down his cheeks. Then Kabuo went forward with his rifle and squatted beside the German boy on his right, and the boy put his hand on Kabuo's boot and shut his eyes and gave out. The tension stayed in his mouth for a while, and Kabuo watched until it faded. The smell of breakfast soon rose from the German boy's bowels. Kabuo sat in his prison cell now and examined his reflection carefully. It was not a thing he had control over. His face had been molded by his experiences as a soldier, and he appeared to the world seized up inside precisely because this was how he felt. It was possible for him all these years later to think of the German boy dying on the hillside, and to feel his own heart pound as it had as he squatted against the tree, drinking from his canteen, his ears ringing, his legs trembling.